Hot new drama is coming to Disney Plus.
5, 6, 7, 8.
When lives are at stake.
I have a pulse.
We gotta move fast.
Hearts are racing.
I love you, and I'm gonna love you.
And family is everything.
All right, team. We work side by side.
New drama can't wait. Set a reminder to stream the latest seasons of Grey's Anatomy and 911.
Welcome back.
And the new series, Dr. Odyssey.
Brace for impact.
Exclusively on Disney Plus. Streaming this October from $4.99 a month, 18 plus subscription required.
With Three, you can get 9 months half price on a Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra powered by Galaxy AI. Available with unlimited data from £44.50 a month for the first 9 months, plus annual price rises and £50 up front on our value plan. Search Three or head in-store today. Life needs a big network.
24-month airtime plan. 36-month device plan from £60 a month from month 10. Price rises each April by £1.50.
You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network, the premier source for role-playing game entertainment. Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Network.
What is going on, everybody in the nation? Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. It is Wednesday, November 6th, 2024, and I've got a special guest today. I'm your old pal, Joe O'Brien. I am not joined by Troy LaValle today. Those of you watching the video can already see my good buddy on the call, happy to hang for FOD today, with founder of the Glass Cannon Network, Matthew Kabatakaza. What's up, pal?
Not much. How are you?
I am fantastic, dude. Sorry, it just took me a second there to get those lower thirds to slide in. Joe O'Brien and Matthew Kabatakaza with you here today for a very special fodder. Those of you that have been following along on Campaign 2, Gatewalkers, and paying close attention, who are all caught up, know that it is a dire situation for the PCs. And some may say that situation has been perpetrated by a variety of factors, but perhaps none larger than the actions of the character played by Matthew Kabatakaza. Today on Cannon Fodder, we are
strong
not
words. Strong words.
We'll get to it. Oh, don't worry. We'll get to it today on Cannon Fodder. Of course, we're going to do a little bit of news. Of course, I'm going to delve into Matthew's personal life in a way that might make him uncomfortable. No. We are going to catch up with Matthew. We haven't caught up with Matthew for a while, so that's going to be great. Get to know what's going on with him. And then we're going to talk Gatewalkers for a little bit and talk strategy as we come to a pivotal point in the campaign. Before, of course, doing a little listener mail at the end, and you're going to love this question, Matthew. I think it's a great one. Cool. So let's get some news out of the way quick. I do want to let everybody know up front that due to some scheduling issues, this FOD was recorded a little earlier than usual. And so there will not be a full We Are Stupid segment because Professor Eric has not yet been able to do the episode. And that's my fault because I'm recording this just a little bit too soon. But don't worry, we'll get to that next week. I know there's going to be some juicy stuff in there. And Professor Eric is going to probably rip me a new one. But we'll talk about that next week.
I saw were unexpected ways we were stupid.
Yes. Well, we could talk about that. We'll do a little ad hoc. We Are Stupid, but it's not going to be the official segment because Professor Eric has not had a chance to weigh in yet. I must give him his due voice in this matter, and that you will hear on next week's Cannon Fodder on November 13th. Troy has not streamed in a long time. Now, we did do Extra Life, and this is being recorded before that, so I'm not really, I don't want to talk all about the debrief of Extra Life. We'll do that next week as well. But the outside of Extra Life, Troy has not streamed in a while, but he's streaming this week. In fact, he's streaming today. So those of you that may not are listening to this early, you can catch him live at 11 a.m. Eastern today, Wednesday, November 6th, streaming Call of Duty Black Ops 6. Those of you that are catching this a little bit later, go back and check out the VOD if you want to see Troy no-scoping some fools. It should be a great time. Otherwise, pretty standard schedule for us this week. Legacy, Blood of the Wild, tomorrow night, big episode of the Glass Cannon podcast. Don't miss it. Premiering at 8 p.m. Eastern on YouTube.tv. YouTube.tv/Glass Cannon. All right. So with that out of the way, I want to welcome Matthew back to the FOD. I mean, you were on here a couple weeks ago, but with the whole crew, obviously there was a lot going on there. We were talking about lots of stuff. In the past 2 years, really since the ramp up to Gatewalkers, Troy and I have just done a lot of FODs together because we've been giving everybody behind the scenes looks of the day to day operations of building the studio, getting it ready for Gatewalkers, launching Gatewalkers, and then the analysis of Gatewalkers from the GM perspective. We've had a couple really fun all player cannon fodders, but it's honestly been a long time since you and I have just chatted on fodder about what's going on. And so I'm excited to do that. We'll get to the barns and the story and the tactics, and we'll get to that stuff in a minute. To jump off, though, I would just like to hear how you're doing, and particularly how work is going on the writing end of things. Get us caught up. Get the Nash caught up. What have you been working on? What's been going on in that world?
Things have been good. I'm gearing up for a workshop of a play of mine that will then feed into a production early 2025 of my play called The Scenarios, which is going to be at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. In the Mid-Atlantic region. You can, if you want to come check that out. Yeah. So I'm getting ready for the workshop, which we go down for a week with the actors and the director and some,
So you'll go down to Washington for a week.
Yeah.
And you'll sit in a room with the script out with the actors and just sort of like work through it.
Yeah. I mean,
make changes.
Yeah. I have a specific change I want to try. Like we'll figure out the structure, but usually it's some version of like, oh, okay. Like I want to work on this. I want to try that. I have an ending I want to try. So I'll make change. I might come down with that. I might do it while I'm there, depending on how, it shakes out. We'll read it. We'll figure it out. We'll talk about it. We'll kind of go through the play,
How many people are involved in this we?
I think there's five actors in the play. Yeah, there's five actors in the play. So me, the director, I'm a dramaturg who works for the theater, at least one. I'm sure there'll be a few other artistic staff there. Mm-hmm. Presumably, at some point the artistic director will come by, the associate artistic director, folks will come in. We might do some sort of a little bit of a read for donors and the staff, but nothing public. It's just more of a chance to kind of get in and try stuff out and see what's working and see. And I'm going to be listening for stuff I can cut and little trims I can make. So we can do that in advance of going into rehearsals. And obviously things are going to change in rehearsals too, but this kind of gives us the opportunity to get in there.
When did you write this play?
The first draft, 2018. It was the first play I brought into Juilliard. Yeah.
Wow. Say that again. It was the first play you wrote out of Juilliard?
First thing I brought in to Juilliard. So it was we had to write three plays a year, and this was the first one I brought in.
Interesting. And why does it sort of take so long to get to this point? Was it just sitting there, nobody was interested, and then this theater company found it?
I mean, this one's had a little bit of an interesting journey. I mean, that said, a number that's passed around that the average gestational life of a play from kind of like first draft to first production is about 5 to 6 years often. This one has had a little bit of an interesting journey in that like I was scared of it and I put it away and then I brought it back out and then I put it away again. And then people read it and then I was weird about it. And anyway, it was long. And then also there was a pandemic in the middle of it. So yeah. there was a time when no one was doing any plays. So it kind of went away from there. So yeah, it is strange though to come back to it. I've rewritten it since 2018 many times, but it's strange to be back in something that I hadn't really kind of been intimately involved in since 2021. I think I did the last major rewrite.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. So, quick tangent offshoot that just came into my mind. Have you written any COVID based plays? Like plays are kind of set against the COVID. Okay. I was wondering if that's something you ever dove into. Has that hit theaters at all? Have there been plays surrounding the story of COVID? Okay.
Though
or how it impacted people?
Not a ton. I feel like there have been stuff I've been working on since that acknowledges the existence of the pandemic, but it's not like, we're set in lockdown. And I don't think, honestly, there have been a bunch of people who were like, oh, I'm writing my lockdown play. And I'm like, why?
Well, why?
Does anyone want to see that?
Why is that your reaction, your first reaction?
Sure, it's an experience we all went through, but also it wasn't entirely pleasant, to put it mildly. And it's like, I don't know. I don't necessarily, never say never, but I don't necessarily want to see a, like, I don't, on my rare time where I can get out to the theater and I have childcare and all of the things, do I really want to go sit down and watch Lockdown?
And relive Lockdown.
Now, that said, maybe something brilliant will come out of it. And actually, I'm working on something else that does it kind of is set against the backdrop of the pandemic. So I guess I shouldn't shoot myself in the foot prematurely. But the, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people had that instinct, but also there was a lot of writing going on during the pandemic. You know, there was a lot of kind of online theater that was happening that was effectively set during lockdown.
Yeah.
I just want to be in a room with people. I'd rather, like, if I'm going to go to the theater, I want to be in a room with real people.
Yeah. All right. So let's get back to it. You are going down to workshop this thing. What's that going to be? A week?
Week.
A couple weeks? One week. And then this is to target when? Will the play be in? Will it do? Whatever it's called. What's it called? Before it opens. Previews. Will it do previews, or does a show like this just open?
We do previews. It's not the kind of lengthy preview process you'd get in New York, where it's like you get like 4 or 5 weeks of previews, which is a luxury. This, I believe, has a week of previews or something. So we officially open, I can tell you, as I have my calendar out, March 2nd, 2025, at the Studio Theater.
March 2nd, 2025. What's the name of the theater?
The Studio Theater
in Washington, D.C. How long will it run?
I think like a month-ish with a possible extension.
Okay.
So if you, I'll post about it on my Instagram. But if you are so inclined, I believe you can buy subscription packages now. I don't think you can buy individual tickets yet, but I will be all over that when it happens.
That's great. So, that's the main news in the playwriting side of things. What about you and I talk about this sometimes off air, but I'd love for you to share what you're willing to share. Like, what about the movie business? Aren't you writing stuff for LA as well? Screenplays, TV episodes, whatever, concepts. How has all that been going? Is it frustrating? Has it been great? Like, how are you feeling about that end of things?
I mean, it's such a different world. I don't know that this is actually, like, if I actually were to get into it, I don't know if it would actually be interesting, but it's so wildly different. It's such a different experience, which I actually find kind of fun and interesting. I mean, I guess the way to sum it up, and I'm not talking in terms of the medium itself, like obviously writing plays and writing movies, which is mostly what I'm doing, is very, very, they're very, very different endeavors. They just work differently. So aside from that, they're just, The other major difference is that when you're the playwright, you own the work. It's you own the copyright. You, like, no one can change it. You have the final say on what is, like, what's in the play and what's not. And obviously people who are helped there, and it's a collaborative art, and people are giving feedback and trying things, and you're making changes in collaboration. But ultimately, like, if you're like, I don't want that scene, I don't want that scene, right? And or if I do want that scene, I do want that scene. in writing movies, the writer is, I mean, honestly, the least important person in a lot of the conversations. But I often find that when I get, even on something an original screenplay written by, like, I had the idea, I wrote the screenplay on spec, and then we sell it and we're taking it out. Like, even in that situation, I still feel like I am just there to solve other people's problems. Like, you just feel you're there kind of to make other people, give other people what they need, which is kind of like
when I get a pre-written module for Delta Green, where I'm like, it's just suggestions. Like, I love the idea of this story, but I'm going to change this, and I'm going to change this, and I'm going to change this. But, like, I love the concept, the hook, whatever it is, but I'm going to adjust, like, all of these things. Does it kind of feel that way? Like, people just like the idea, or maybe one of the characters, and then they want to change all of these things around it?
I mean, if I'm adapting something, sure. Yeah, like, that. I've been in those situations where it's like, usually in those situations, like, it's not just me. It's like the producers are like, we like this. About this, about this book, or like, so we want you to do, like, we want you to write a script that, like, pulls this out of it. And I might, and like, usually you have to pitch, right? So I'd say, like, for me, what's interesting about this, and usually that's how I would come to it. It's like, okay, I read this book. I think it's really cool. I think it's got a really cool idea. I love this character. Love this character. I love the situation they get into. What's interesting and like alive and electric to me about this is X. And I think the way we would pull that out and make it cinematic as opposed to literary is to do these things. You know, I would watch.
But what I'm asking is, like, when you write an original screenplay and it gets into somebody else's hands, like, is that what they? Does it feel that way that they like your idea, but they don't need you anymore? They're going to make all these changes to it that they want to make because they feel that they have a better idea of what would make a better movie.
Oh, no, see, this is the interesting thing. I still have to be involved. Like, they still, like, I'm, like, they, or a writer does. They can fire me. Like, you know, they can hire somebody else, but a writer right. has to be involved. So they can be like, this, like, the notes, as like the notes you get on movie stuff, as well as the notes you get on plays, they function very differently. they're very direct. I usually see it as like, oh, I'm a hired gun. I'm here to, even on something of my own, like, I kind of feel like I'm a hired gun. I'm here to give the director what they need and the producers what they need. And usually, like, it's, I mean, this, I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn because, you know, my experience is I've only been in these situations for 4 or 5 years now, but the like, you get on a call with a lot of people and they all have a slightly different version of the movie in their head based on reading the script. So they're all giving notes to kind of get to the version they like. And then there's politics that you're not even aware of. And like, people were kind of politicking on their own and you don't know, like, what they're reacting to, you know, some that they're reacting to market forces that I've never heard of, you know, or know nothing about. So like, you're usually trying to like, okay, how do I give that person the thing they need that even though it directly contradicts the thing that this person wants, but that person is this person's boss. So I have to kind of
And these people that are talking are pretty much all director and producers.
There's usually only the one director, but then you also have the executives that work for the production company or the studio, whoever.
Right.
And they're, you know, everyone's, and also like, but honestly, like, everyone's usually trying to get the movie made. Like, that's the goal. It's just everyone has different ideas about how to make that happen, which is.
And you weird. And I have talked about this, and I think it came up on Legacy before and during Bant, but just like what a miracle it is whenever any movie is made.
Any movie. Yeah.
I mean, to actually be completed is such an astounding feat.
It is true. Like, I think the other thing advice I've been is like, every movie has to fight for its existence. So it's like, you know, and I like on every script that I've been lucky enough to work on, like, they've all been through such twisty Byzantine paths and note that none of them have been made. hopefully, like, knock wood, but the, you know, so.
Yeah. So we're talking about all this stuff and you can't even point anybody to a movie that's been made. Like, I know, all of this is still working and working, fighting just to like breathe.
And I feel very like fortunate and lucky that I've gotten to work on the projects that I've been able to work on. And yet I cannot point to a single, you know, produced movie, which is another astounding thing about the industry. Is like, you can work and earn a living and not actually make any movies.
that is so wild. That is hilarious.
It's just it's a very silly industry in a lot of ways. I mean, like, it is fun. It is weird and frustrating and in ways that I had never encountered before in any other creative act, but it, which I guess is the name of the game, right? Every different medium has their own kind of you things. But I don't know. The thing I do really like about it, and I think I really do gravitate about it, is that, you know, I'm there for other people, right? I am, as much as I care and as much as I want like certain things in the movie for storytelling reasons, like, I do at the end of the day, like, I was once in a deep discussion with this director who I love, and like, we're working on multiple projects together. But we were in an argument about something, and I was like making a case for like why this moment had to be in the movie because it sets up this other thing, which then comes up in something. And eventually he kind of just went, he was like, you can write it, but I'm not going to shoot it. And I was like, well, I guess that's the end of it, right? It's like,
I guess that's that.
I guess that's that.
Oh, man. That's just wild. Well, I'm happy to hear about this play. It's very exciting. I believe you've let us know that you are going to be in DC for a large chunk of this run, right? Yeah. Like, you'll be living down there, essentially staying down there.
I'll be there for rehearsals, and then I'll be there through opening, and then I'll be back up in New York.
Rehearse. So, yeah. So a month or so? Is that how long?
Roughly February, I'll be in DC. I'll be popping back up. I have, you know, a family that I would like to see.
Right, right.
And they might come down for a week and we'll figure it out.
What a cool experience. Well, I hope it all goes well. And obviously, we've let people know, like, keep an eye out. What's it called again?
The scenarios.
The scenarios, March 2nd at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. Very, very cool.
With three, you can get 9 months half price on a Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra powered by Galaxy AI. Available with unlimited data from £44.50 a month for the first 9 months, plus annual price rises and £50 up front on our value plan. Search three or head in-store today. Life needs a big network.
24-month airtime plan. 36-month device plan. From £60 a month from month 10. Price rises each April by £1.50.
At Barclays, we run programs that help communities across the UK. Whether you're a young person gaining skills to enter the workplace, a small business trying to grow and find its place in the modern world, or a girl in school building confidence on and off the pitch through football. We believe everyone deserves to fly. Search Barclays Communities to find out more. Barclays, here for every goal.
Adobe Express is the quick and easy create anything app. It's my go-to for making my business stand out. From videos and social posts to flyers and logos. Search for Adobe Express to find out more and use it for free.
All right, now let's talk about what we work on together, the show that we write together week in and week out, live with no rewrites. And first draft is the draft you
decisions.
See. I just had you on a couple weeks ago with Sydney and Skid, and we obviously talked through our thoughts and feelings and reactions to the end of book one, the shuttling from world to world, the wildness of how that all worked out, not only from a design standpoint, from a game design standpoint, but how it worked for us personally, tactically, what that forced us into and how we had to kind of make these decisions. Well, one big reveal from Troy last week on Cannon Fodder is that he decided in this kind of mayhem that to not level us up. So like there is a level up between book one and book two, but he has decided that we need to rest to get that level up. And so perhaps we're like a little bit behind the curve, but he also believes pretty strongly that this introductory encounter is designed with lower level enemies that are should not be too problematic for us. Well, we do finish off these raiders that barge in. However, one runs away, and that's where we left on our last Cannon Fodder that you appeared on, not knowing what Barnes's decision was. But now we know you decide to pursue. And then the enemy, you know, runs far enough away that there is another moment of like, well, wait a minute, should I really stop here or and go back inside the observatory, or should I continue deeper and deeper into the city following this guy? We know from Sakaguchi that there's strange stuff going on in the city. It's dangerous out there. You might get lost or something. We yell, Bards, come back, something along those lines. And you're like, I'm going to move up to this enemy and just take him out so he can't get back to his people, thus unleashing the ambush. So, and that's the thicket that we are still in right now, trying to fight our way out of this ambush. So I guess I want you to take it back to pursuing the raider. You talked a little bit about the thought process live during the show, but talk me through it now in hindsight, just that moment of going deeper into the city to get to this raider. What was going on in your head as a player, and how does that correlate to what Barnes as a character might have been thinking that might have motivated that choice?
So the two main factors were we couldn't barricade ourselves. It felt like
the door was shattered down.
Door was shattered. That was the information.
There was no
had.
Way to barricade.
So it was not truly, we couldn't like make a stronghold here, you know, or even a, you know,
defensible position.
Right. So it felt like, I think from Barnes's perspective, it was like, this guy's going to get away. Presumably he has some more friends. And if we don't shut that down, those friends are going to come, you know, be visited upon us. We all needed to rest. You know, it was, and we'd be, and there were also not for nothing, even with the door closed, this is not a great, particularly defensible position because it's just a big open room.
Right. And they already knocked it down once. They can do it again. We certainly don't have time to fix it. And every 10 minutes is valuable in one way or another. But like to reinforce what you're saying, I think it's pretty safe to say logically that you wouldn't be able to sleep for 8 hours.
No.
Right? So, and that's the thing we needed the most was rest to get spell slots back, stuff like that. And it felt like we couldn't get that if this raider found people and brought them back.
And Brother Ramius, love him though I do, 10 minutes is not enough to get all of us back up to fighting shape. You know, we're looking at more like 50 minutes, but maybe more, maybe like an hour and a half, you know, depending on if you fail rolls. And right. So, I mean, like, so
you're also thinking if you kill this guy, then no one's going to come and we can actually rest.
That was my thing. That was Barnes's thinking. So like there was going to be some sort of, you know, hammer to fall. Yeah. I was like, mechanically, I was like, sure. Presumably there is going to be another encounter outside, but I couldn't shake the logic that like, if we don't get this guy, more people could find us right away. And especially given the fact that like the city, you get lost in the city, right? So we know that even venturing outside, all five of us together, all six of us, would be dangerous and risky. So it was like, I couldn't track like not following this guy. Now, I also felt that, you know, if I was thinking purely mechanically, or it was like, okay, there will definitely be an encounter outside, but also like, but we're in this unfavorable map. Everyone's hurt. We're not going to be able to rest. Maybe we can do some treat wounds that will help, but we're not going to be in tip top fighting form. Like, I just was like, I understand why it was a mistake. I do admit it was a mistake, but I think the logic from like Barnes's perspective, I still stand by in a weird way. Like, like the mistake is a mistake that I think he would make again, not on purpose. But.
Do you know if this raider, do you recall if this raider had full health?
I don't remember.
Let's assume they either did or were slightly injured. Doesn't it stand to reason from a metagame perspective that like it's so hard to single hand down an enemy ever?
You know, I actually
even a minion, unless they're a real low level minion.
I think he had been hit. I think he had been hit a bunch actually, because I remember thinking, because my original strategy was I will chase him, I can follow him out one action, glint the mirror two action flank, or at least like get in front of him, strike third action, and then it could be done. Like, and then it could be done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he wasn't the movement. He double moved and then I was like, oh, I can see him. But then I still thought I could either in like another turn get in front of him. And
I mean, the first time you closed on him at all, you triggered the ambush. Like the first time you got within melee, you saw all the enemies there and you were able to trigger that ambush. Or you were able to see that there were at least two more and at least one of them was beefy. A leader of some kind. And you get yourself into all of us really into a really difficult position. Does it ever occur to you that if you let him go, we would be fine? Like as a player, like, are you like, there's a chance that if I let him go, we could rest? Or did you think that was like almost no chance that there'd be a rest?
I didn't think there was going to be a rest. I think their entire mode of attack was teamwork. Like they were organized. Like they had that, what was the ability?
Formation.
The formation. Yeah. So they had the formation. They seemed organized. Like they seemed like,
I don't think I'll ever hear the word formation again, at least in the next couple of years, and not think of this.
Yeah, I know, right?
Like we said it so many goddamn times and they just kept moving up next to each other, getting all these bonuses. Yeah,
getting in formation.
Like, God. Pain in the ass.
They seem more than just like some people who are just out looting observatories, right? I think they seemed organized. It stood to reason, which I think was confirmed by the next episode, was like they were part of a larger force, and they were you know, kind of paramilitary in a way, right? They had fighting tactics.
Yes.
So I guessed from even when they first entered, we started fighting them, that these are part of a larger group.
Let me ask you another question. I'm trying. I want you to try to be as honest as possible here.
You can poke plenty of holes in my argument.
It's not an argument. I just want to I know it can be hard to look back weeks before, because this is recorded weeks ago, and know what was going on in your head. But, you know, it's like being a witness to a crime, right? You're like on the stand a year after the thing happened and you're asking these fine point details about what you were thinking. It can be a little bit tough. It's also why, and I love this about the law, why like one of the most clearly inadmissible things that you'll hear objected to over and over is when anyone else testifies as to what someone else was thinking.
Right?
Because it's just so, it's so tough to wrap your head around, because I, of course, come to it with my own mind, my own thoughts of what I was thinking at the time. And I know very clearly what I was thinking on both sides. I'm curious if the thought, did you ever think about the show?
Yes.
Like, did the show occur to you? And did you think that if you ran into more danger and created a bigger combat, that it would be great for the show?
I thought when Troy described the world outside, Sakauchi was describing the way, you know, the streets, they're one way, another way. I think I thought, well, if I go out there, I think the as far as I got with it in the moment was like, if I go out there and kill this guy and then suddenly I can't get back into the observatory, that's cool story. Like that, mm-hmm. like that's cool for like now. You know, I don't know. A TPK is a pretty good story too. I don't think that was what I was hoping for, but I know it wasn't what I was hoping for. But I think the way my mind went, it was like, well, you can kill this guy and get back in. That'd be good. That'd be great. That like that's the ideal scenario. And then secondary, I kill him and then can't get back in or can't find the observatory again. Like that's cool. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. And if I chase this guy through the streets and get lost, and it's just me and him, kind of like, you know, running around a city of shifting streets, like that's also cool. And then you guys having to decide, like, do we go after Barnes? Do we wait here? Do we,
right.
You know,
now I am going to put you on the stand. Well then would you agree then that going back in that moment and letting the Raider run and reuniting with the group and simply resting is not as interesting of a story? Just yes or no, please.
Ask it again so I know what yes means and no means.
No, I'm saying, do you believe, I think we're all telling stories, right? We talked about workshopping. We're all writing live.
Yeah.
And the problem is that like there is no rewrite. You just got to kind of go with what happens. And that's also really part of the fun of it. Did you think that going back and resting is also kind of lame? To be honest, from a storytelling perspective, did that thought occur to you?
I don't think it did occur to me. I think I thought, because like, believe me, I would have loved to rest. I love for you to rest in particular, but the,
love a good rest.
I love a good rest.
We always love a good rest.
I just didn't think that was a likely scenario. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't think it was going to be likely that we'd all be able to like, yeah, let's just sleep for 8 hours.
Okay. But you thought, you really truly believed that if Barnes, as a player in the meta, that if you killed this guy before he could get back to his people, that there was a chance we could rest.
That would buy us time to find a defensible position within the observatory, barricade the door, or find another room. Like, we didn't even know what else was in the building.
At least buy us hours at minimum, probably.
A basement, something, who knows.
Okay. All right. Now let's move forward.
In the moment. So you're asking me now to apply a lot more thought and scrutiny to my thoughts.
Yeah.
Than I had time to at the time.
I agree. I get that. But I also think that like sometimes you have to be in awe of the human mind and like how many thoughts can occur to you in an incredibly short amount of time.
Yeah.
In literal seconds that you could kind of like weigh a lot of different things and just make a quick decision. Sure. In hindsight, you might be like, that was a mistake. But like, you think, man, a lot of things went through my head in that moment.
Well, I mean, in hindsight, I'm like, I'm also explaining what Troy might have done, right? Like, knowing now that there was this other group outside, if we had just let the guy go, and I mean, he'd just been like, all right, let's go to rest. Troy probably would interrupt the rest, right? I mean, if he was being generous, he might let us heal, and then we're like, all right, let's go rest, and then we'd probably get jumped. So. Right. Like, I'm knowing Troy, it's probably how
that rolls into the meta
it.
As well. Yep.
Yes.
Now, anybody can change their story in hindsight. We're certainly allowing for that. It's all speculative to a certain extent. But while interviewed on this show last week, Troy said that if you let him go, he would have let us rest. He said that was his intention, because he knew how beat up we were, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, we'll take that for what it's worth, especially in hindsight. He did not seem to be rabble-rousing. He just was like, that was my intention, was just to end it there and rest, level up, etc. Once the pursuit happened, he thought, oh man, this is really dangerous. And, this is undeniably going to be great for the show, like action packed. Right. So anyway, that was what he said. And, I think some people asked, in the cannon fodder, comments if that, changed my mind at all, or if I yelled at you off air after hearing Troy say that. And I was like, no, of course not. Because, like, you also have to take it with a grain of salt. You don't know 100% that that's what he would have done, because he might have changed his mind if he saw a great story moment to interrupt arrest. That could have been really
interrupting
fun.
Interrupting arrest is like something we do so rarely, right?
It's a really fun story thing to do. So, I don't know. Well, everybody kind of like goes off the cuff at the last minute while we're playing. So you're never really sure what's going to happen. Let's move a little bit forward then. Now you're caught, okay? Caught. Ambush.
Yeah.
Alone. Out in the city. Talk to me just through tactics and those first few moments. And I kind of want a bigger picture idea. I want to know what you were thinking in those first moments. I know what you came up with tactically was to shimmer the mirror, drop into the channel, into the little canal there. That was awesome. But, like, my bigger question is, like, What is your long-term plan here? What was sort of developing? Were you like, I got to get back to the thing, to the observatory? Were you like, I could just disappear into the city? Talk to me about like what your first initial tactics were on a macro level.
I think I said this in the episode, like I was like, in my defense, I did make a mistake. But I didn't expect you to follow me. I mean, like, isn't that like the conventional wisdom of the, like, if when someone splits the party, like, it's like, okay, have fun.
Good luck. Yeah.
I mean, I think that was my plan. And I think I would, like, had we been within shouting distance, I would have said something to the effect of, like, I'll lead these guys away and maybe the streets will shift, or maybe I can use my mirror to, like, get into a building and hide or whatever.
Yeah.
But that was my intent. It was like to get lost in the city and I felt confident that I could. I think, especially when I went in the water, I had the advantage of them not being able, it wasn't as easy to hit me. So I felt confident that I could get away. But then Troy pressed you guys, and then you guys came out of the observatory. So then I was like, oh, well, we're fucked now. We're.
So your thinking was like, stay hold up there, guys, and I'll kite them into the city and then hopefully just lose them.
Yeah.
In the city, and then double back at some later point to reconnect with everybody, or maybe Barnes is lost for an episode or two or something. That's kind of fun. So that was what you were thinking, but then Buggles comes out and comes out a decent distance and triggers another raider off to the side that we also didn't see in your initial launch out there. And then now Buggles is down and Buggles is dying. Brutal. So,
which might as well be a TPK.
Right, exactly. So at this point, you're now thinking, I got to turn and fight.
Yeah, though I like my turn and the turn and fight is hard because, I'm down. I'm hurt. I'm very hurt. So
with no healer in sight. And actually, even if I was in sight, I don't think there's anything much I could do for you.
Yeah. So, and it, we've all been rolling so terribly, and I've been rolling so terribly. I'm not confident in my ability to hit these guys. I have to roll well. Yes, I can flank with myself, but that's an extra action. And I usually, and like to get in, these guys have AOOs. So to get in close and be able to move away, I need to kind of conserve the mirror to use that way too. So tough. I think I also want to say I wanted to kite the guy with the bow. Like that was my strategy toward the end of last episode, which was me. General strategy was to kite them around the city. But I think specifically what I want to do with this guy is lead him on the merry chase with me to give you guys some extra time to see what you can do with the ones that are on top of you. Kiting, not really the right word. The strategy was like, okay, let me get this guy to like follow me around and then I can mirror across the water to kind of force him to spend actions on a move that he could be using to close on the group. I felt more confident in my ability to kind of run and dodge, jump in the water, for Troy to hit me with, like, give Troy a chance to hit me with the bow instead of being up close where we get multiple attacks that would most likely hit.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
We'll see.
You know, it is kind of depressing. This is something that has really grinded on us, I think, a bit in Gatewalkers is like, I remember you saying on air, maybe you've definitely said it on air and you've definitely said it off air, like it talking about specific moments and specific encounters, like in this one where you're across the channel from the Bowman Raider and you're kind of in this standoff while the other two run up to like face us as we pull back into the observatory. And you're just like, I mean, like, no, I'm not going to like attack him. I can't hit him. You know what I mean? And it's just so depressing. It's like, we feel like a regular hit, if they're not flanked, if they're not debuffed in some way, any average enemy, like, it's just like a wasted action. You feel like it's so weird. It's been working us down. And part of that is die rolls. Part of it is that, like, most of the time we have to hit at 14 or 15 natural to hit these guys. But like, it feels like you can never even roll that because we always have been rolling so low. I mean, speaking of rolls, let's talk about the elephant in the room that hasn't been addressed yet. The most ridiculous, most absurd, most embarrassing, pathetic, yet I guess entertaining to people roll that I have ever had, I think, on the Glass Cannon Network. The preposterousness to be invited because of how shitty I roll to roll saving throws for the enemy on a sleep spell. And then to just roll back-to-back natural 20s out of nowhere after consecutive single digits over and over and over to then roll two natural 20s to save them out of sleep so that there is no effect of the spell on them whatsoever. What a moment. I think it truly captured, I mean, watching your face is amazing, especially on the second one, because you're just like you are truly astounded. You are a firsthand witness. You were sitting right there. You saw it hit the tray. Saw it all happen. You were right there. I don't know.
I prepared
any thoughts
a list
on that before I turn to YouTube comments?
I've prepared a list. Things that are more likely to happen than rolling two natural 20s in a row. The odds are better that you would be born ambidextrous. that's 1 in 100. So now the rest of these end up just kind of being about dying. So you are more likely to be born with extra fingers or toes. This one's not about dying. No, I'm sorry. That's about roughly, you know, that actually you're a little more likely to roll two natural 20s in a row. It's 1 in 500. To be born with extra fingers or toes. It was a 1 in 400 chance to roll, you know, roll two natural 20s in a row.
Wow.
You are more likely, more likely to die from a drug overdose. You are more likely
that's sad
to develop rheumatoid arthritis.
I think I do have that already, probably.
You are more likely, I was like, you're more likely to die in a car accident than to roll two natural 20s in a row. I mean, lifetime versus a discrete incident. So I don't know if these are exactly parallel, but it was just like, it was astounding. It was true.
Oh,
have you ever done that before?
Back-to-back nat 20s? You know, I think that I'm sure that I have for like confirming or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh, a third one, you kill him. Like, we've done that before. Back-to-back nat, it's just the situation, because it's not just a one in... It's way, 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 way longer shot than a 1 in 400 chance, right? Because you're talking about what is the chance of rolling back-to-back 20s in one specific instance.
When you need ones.
When you are being asked to roll for the enemy, then that happens like once or twice in a campaign. You're talking about once in a lifetime, right? Like it'll never happen again that you'll roll back-to-back natural 20s when you're asked to roll force for an enemy. I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
Likely to be a victim of identity theft than to roll back-to-back natural 20s.
I was a victim of identity theft. I talked about it a lot in my NordVPN reads. My NordVPN ad reads.
You're more likely to be audited by the IRS.
Oh, my God. All right, let's go to just a couple comments here because this is amazing. The video airs on YouTube and people just come in with some great stuff. I like this one. Oh my gosh, I just lost it. I wonder if it got
more likely to die from a fall.
Oh my God. sorry, where was it? I had a great one, and it was like, oh, from Leon at Leon Kirk 5280 says, I laughed so hard at Joe's double nat 20s that I got a cramp in my neck. Sorry about that. I like this one. At DeSquire says, Joe is what statisticians use to frighten each other around a campfire. That was a good comment for a Halloween. Man, just what an insane, insane moment. At prop 4793 wants art of me screaming after rolling the natural 20s, just screaming to the sky. But yeah, anyway, that was a ridiculous moment. And there was another comment in here that I haven't been able to find at the moment. And this is the one I really wanted to get to, but I can't find it live, unfortunately. So I'll shout your, you know who you are. The gist of the comment is, and I think a couple people made comments around this, but it's that it's less about Joe, these comments, and more about like these series of die rolls and the two natural 20s back to back are really the icing on the cake, is like the universe saying they want gatewalkers to stop because we've rolled so poorly in this campaign. It really feels like an epidemic of bad rolling in this campaign. It's been brutal.
It's been so brutal.
It really has. It feels cursed. And so some people have said
I think I alluded to this on the last time I was on Cannon Fodder, just because of the nature of the APs, we're facing a lot of high level enemies. We're not facing those minions like we were we're facing them, you know, en masse. I think what felt nice about the first Hobgoblin fight was felt like, oh, we can roll, we don't have to roll a 15 to hit. Like, I feel like this might be a function of the math of 2E, but, you know, when I'm playing Ethel, obviously Ethel has a lot going for him as a fighter, but, you know, I can roll a 10 and hit even a high level enemy on my first attack. So it doesn't feel like the stakes are so high with every roll, even right. though I'm rolling probably equally as badly over time.
Yeah.
It's so brutal. I think it doesn't feel like we've been given the combination of us rolling badly, the nature of the AP and the math of 2E have combined to make it feel very oppressive as a player. Like, I'm not really like, it almost changes the way I want to, like, the characters I want to bring in, assuming, Barnes is eventually going to die because, I don't know, might be in a TPK, but it changes the nature of the characters I want to bring in the future, right? Where it's like, how can I pull a Joe and develop a character where I have to roll a die as little as possible? And just
I mean, that's the point of Brother Ramius, and then Troy makes this happen. Pretty wild ride. Well, we are still in the midst of it. It remains to be seen what the conclusion will be, and that is coming next week. So, or this week, sorry, tomorrow night, actually. Tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern, watch the premiere. Don't miss it. Don't miss it live. And let's talk just for a brief second. We Are Stupid, before we get into a listener mail, and then we'll get out of here. We Are Stupid. I've just seen the YouTube comments talking about Rousing Splash and that temporary hit points don't work that way. Don't bring people up. I'll wait for perfect. Nobody really cited specific pages and where that comes from. I haven't gone looking just yet, but I just want to know where that's from, and then we'll cite that next week, and we'll get into the nitty gritty on what that rule is, and then how we can apply it more in the future. I'm not sure if there's anything else that jumped out to you, Matthew, rules wise, but we'll do a deeper dive next week on We Are Stupid.
Yeah, I saw a little bit about the text of what causes my mirrored double to disappear. And I've been playing it as if you move, including, if I fall, I am moving out of a space. But the text of it actually says if you choose to move out of a space. No, I'd argue, say if I were to fall 10 feet and the mirrored image just stays there, it feels a little bit odd. But, that's a thing. So I guess I'm curious to hear what
people say. I mean, you also chose to fall in that instance. It was a designed move.
Yeah. I mean, I've also been trying to manipulate. I've also been trying to, work that technique as much as possible.
You got a lot of mileage out of that mirror, I'll tell you.
Trying, that's what attracted me to is like the interesting ways you could use it.
All right, let's get into a question from the Nation here on a little listener mail, and then we will get out of here. Sing us in, good buddy Nick.
It's time to listen to mail. Oh, yeah, get your brain up on it. Time to listen to me. You gotta cue that.
All right, this one from Mac Deer in Burlington, Washington, says, since Campaign 2, there's been a lot of talk about being invested in the story slash adventure path and how some are struggling with it. This has come up a couple times on Fodder, Matthew, just the variance between people on, say, YouTube, who say they love the show, they love everything about the campaign, and then people... perhaps popping up on Reddit or on Discord, saying they're just not into it. And so why is this a bit of a polarizing campaign, trying to kind of like analyze what's been working, what hasn't, et cetera? So Mac Deer writes in and says, that has me wondering, what are your guys' favorite moments where the gravity of the story finally hooked you in Giant Slayer, for example, Androids and Aliens, or Gatewalkers, or any of your other stuff? Can you point to a specific moment where you remember being like, wow, I am super into this? Mac Deer's example is when we first, I believe, got to the Minderhall's Valley in Giant Slayer. Like, he was just kind of like along for the ride for like, Minderhall's Valley. Yeah. Along for the ride for like, the laughs, right? We're just having a good time. Yeah. But then when we got to like the hundreds and hundreds of giants, like encampments and all this stuff, it was like, holy shit, this is like a whole, this is really neat. The scope of this just really opened up for me. So, anything jump out at you as answers, to whether it's ANA, whether it was, I don't know, any of the campaigns you've been in, Legacy, anything that jumped out at you as like, oh man, this was a good hook. This is a moment that I'm really into.
I mean, for Giant Slayer, I remember very clearly, I was when the invasion of Drunau at the
end. That's exactly what I was going to say.
And yeah. Specifically, there was the moment where we were in one of the houses, and Gormley almost permanently died. And yeah. But for that, what was it, the 20% mischance?
Yeah.
Gormley would have been dead. And yeah. I was like, that would have been, you know, at that point was my would have been my first character death. And I was like, oh no, like we are in it. Like we're in it. Like it felt very, and the weight of it felt very heavy, in a great way. It was very exciting. And then that whole set piece of that invasion was super engaging to me.
It was awesome. It was really well done. I had never played an adventure like that. I don't want to say a siege, because a siege sort of implies like waiting you out. I'm talking about like a true, they're climbing over the walls invasion. It was very terrifying and really well executed by Troy. And it hooked me in. But in the midst of that, you know, I can't deny it. It's episode 16, I believe, when that group of orcs captured and then killed my character's son in front of me.
Oh, yeah.
16 sessions in to the game. And I was just like, that was a big hook for me. It drives the character for dozens and dozens of episodes after that. That's your only focus is like revenge on these people that did this horrible thing. And so that was a really good one in Giant Slayer.
Yeah.
ANA, you know, one moment that I always remember just being like, wow, this is unlike anything we've played before, it's relatively early on, I think, book one, when we were, do you remember when we had to like shimmy across that line between like the ship and the asteroid?
And the drift rock.
In the drift rock in zero G.
Yeah.
And we were like moving along in zero G, and I could picture that. And I was like, oh man, we are like truly in space now, because you just start on the station really. And you're on the station for a while, like, you know, getting in the sense of Absalom Station. But then that moment was like, oh man, we're really out here in space now. And you had to worry about your space suit and how much, you know, you're breathing and if you get an encounter out here, what would happen? And so, I remember that image. I remember Mac being on the line, like with Dax, and just like, that was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, Legacy is hard, because I feel like I was hooked from the beginning. Like, honestly, like, and also that, and not for nothing, that also starts with an invasion.
It's another invasion. Yeah. Yeah.
Where it's like your home is threatened, right? And you have the kind of, but I'm trying to think too, for Raiders, if there was a moment, because there definitely did feel like when the mystery started to deepen, like, you know, we got there and there was no one in the colony. Like, that was really exciting.
I always remember that, like, moon altar thing where, like, we first started seeing, like, the, like, spirits of the, like, long departed Aslanti, and they were like teachers. Remember that we like learned the language like from these statues or something? Yeah. I always remember that as like a very interesting part where I was like, man, I haven't done anything like this before. This like, you know, 10,000-year-old shrine that is like a school and it can teach you. Yeah. It was once a school for this ancient society that was actually far advanced but had been crumbled in to non-existence. That was really cool. Yeah. Trying to think of what else. I mean, those are some big early moments, but yeah, they all came pretty early. Gatewalkers. I struggled with gatewalkers for a really long time, and then I think it was probably it was really more of a character moment. It was after we had struggled so much, and maybe even lost Talitha, or was it just before Talitha? I can't remember, but it was like that first time we sat around and smoked weed with Brother Ramius and he just got stoned and like was yelling about Troy's other ridiculous NPC,
Hubert.
Hubert. Yeah. Where he was, yelling at Hubert. About like making fun of Hubert. I remember being like, oh my God, I love what we're doing right now. This is so much fun. And that was definitely hooking me into the character of Brother Ramius as like a short tempered, like flailing frontier surgeon, you know, kind of thing. And that's when it started really clicking for me. And that really is right up into the fight with the thin man. Right. So like, you know, when he was doing the surgery on Buggles outside and he heard him and he's just like,
I guess for me, really for Gatewalkers, it is the moment when, we saw like the shadow of Kanipo it was a kind of cliffy, like we were walking back to our,
it was in like an alleyway.
Yeah. We walked past an alleyway and we saw the kind of shadow of a tall, slender figure.
That was super eerie.
That was super great. Obviously that one, you know, then I almost wish we had like been able to live in that a little longer. Yeah, like that kind of, and the bird thing was amazing too. Like finding
I thought Kanipo was like a longer term goal. Like I didn't realize that would be over kind of quick because he was an interesting villain, very disturbing and strange and otherworldly. And
he had been set up as this kind of like, you know, generational enemy, you know, that reincarnate in a different form were a generational enemy. I agree. I expected Kanipo to be around for a lot longer.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Anyway, Mac Deer, thank you for the question. Very good question. An interesting thought experiment. Well, you know, when was the moment you were hooked? Tell us in the comments here on YouTube. Like, what moments in Giant Slayer or Androids and Aliens, Gatewalkers, even if it's Legacy or Blood of the Wild, like what moment jumped out at you where you were like, oh man, I'm really into this campaign. I'm curious to see what people's answers are. Well, Matthew, thank you so much, buddy, for taking the time out, doing a little FOD with
thank me, you for
getting
having me, me.
Getting us in the mind of Matthew at the table, also in the mind of Barnes.
It's a pivotal
moment in the campaign, and it will resolve itself tomorrow night. So tune in 8 p.m. Eastern, the premiere on our YouTube channel. Check it out there. And then if you can't see that, you can also catch it on the podcast by Friday at midnight. So you're good to go. Listen, get caught up because it's going to be a big fodder next week with Troy and I. All right. Thanks, everybody. Take it easy. Have a fantastic rest of your week and weekend. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Peace.
Do you like what you hear? Well, then it's time to make your membership official. You can start your 30-day free trial today and become an official member of The Nash at jointhenash.com with the promo code GCN30. That's jointhenash.com and use code GCN30. That's GCN30 to gain access to exclusive podcasts, ad-free episodes, and live streams you can't find anywhere else. Once again, it's jointhenash.com. Use code GCN30 at sign up to get your first 30 days for free. See what everybody else is talking about and join the Nash today.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry, with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development, with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League, and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. Oracle.com/bandwidth.